Hi everyone, I'm Martin Lefebvre, CIO at National Bank. Welcome and thank you for tuning in to this NBI podcast. Today we're going to talk about a very hot topic, the war in Ukraine, its implications on commodity prices and inflation more generally. We're also going to touch base on supply chain issues and the role of China in this new world order. And to do that, my guest today is none other than our very own Angelo Katsouris, geopolitical strategist here at National Bank. Angelo, welcome and thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
So Angelo, let's dive right in and let's start by giving us a little bit of color around the Ukraine conflict, what started it, or put in other words, what does Putin want and what type of concessions will he be willing to make not to lose face?
Okay, basically, if you go back to the origins of this conflict, from the Russian perspective, they felt that when Russia was weak, the West took advantage of its weakness in the 90s to put NATO right on its border. And from their perspective, they felt that Ukraine was a red line that couldn't be allowed to be passed in terms of, you know, Ukraine falling into the zone of influence of the West, right? And so from their perspective, they, as one Russian person told me, how would America react if Canada joined became a member of a rival military organization to the United States, i.e. joining a Chinese-led organization, for example. And so they felt this was something they couldn't back down on. But from the perspective of the Eastern European members who joined NATO, you know, many years ago, they say, look, we're a democratic country, we have the right to decide our foreign policy. And this, you know, invasion of Ukraine is a perfect reason why we were right to join NATO, right? Because we wouldn't be protected otherwise. So you can see these two widely different perspectives, okay? Now, when you look at the prospects of, you know, for peace right now, recently we've had some press reports coming out talking about the contours of a peace deal where, you know, Ukraine will be neutral, i.e. doesn't join NATO, and they don't join a Russian-led military organization as well. But there's a lot of devil in the details right now, right? There's a devil over what territories Russia will withdraw from. Will they go back to where the territories that they controlled before the invasion? What are the security guarantees? Because Ukraine has said, look, we also want security guarantees to protect our neutrality. What type of army, you know, Russia's asked that to demilitarize, and they're of course going to say no. So the good news is that they're talking. I guess you can say the devil in details is that there's a lot of things to work out, right? That could drag on for a week or so. So well, that's something to keep an eye on, right? That some of these details are going forward, and whether China comes in and pushes in and says, look, you're impacting the global economy. We need you to declare victory, for example, telling Russia.
Okay, so do you see an end to this conflict anytime soon?
Well, you know what? For me, my perspective is that I think there's a good chance that this will continue for a week or so more, right? Maybe it's hard to say like how long, because these details which have to be worked out are quite important. But I do think that the fact that they're talking is that, you know, Russia's getting pressure from China. There's a lot of pressure from all over the world. Its economy's taken a hit, so there are talks, but when you look at the ground, you see the violence is intensifying, right? And so, you know, and so that's the challenge. But I think there are some devils in the details, which means that this might drag on longer than perhaps the markets are taking into account, right? The markets are relieved that the talks are occurring, and that's great news, but there's a lot of things to work out. And the risk has always been, you know, from the economic impact, the longer this war continues, the greater the impact, right? And I would argue, like, for example, like agriculture sector is, you know, it's ground zero, for example, where I think many of us are aware 30% of the agricultural exports when it comes to wheat comes from this region, 10% Ukraine, 20% Russia. But in Ukraine, for example, they were already supposed to have gotten planting season or preparations for planting season underway 2 weeks ago. You're actually supposed to start planting by close to the end of April. Right. And this, you know, the longer this war goes on, the greater the chance that their crop is completely, you know, it's a failure. And then even if the war ends today, you have to deal with damage to the farmlands, to equipment, etc. Then you throw in Russia's agriculture sector. They're not part of a conflict zone, but they're dealing with a spike in interest rates, a spike in insurance rates. They're dealing with boycotts for shipping their goods abroad. You're dealing with the fact that Russia was sending a lot of their agricultural exports through the ports in Ukraine. And so there's a chance when it comes to the agricultural sector, markets will get tighter before they get better, right? So that's one of the impacts that we're going to feel for a long time, even if this war was to end sooner rather than later, right?
Okay. So there's going to be, you see some lasting effect even if the war gets...
Especially for the agriculture sector, because the damage that has been done to the planting, you know, to the, the you know, and you know how far beyond they are, it's hard to undo that even if we end it tomorrow, right? You've fallen behind the preparations for planting. You got to deal with the damage and exploded bombs in the fields, the equipment that might have been destroyed, right? The workers who aren't there. So you you have to deal with all of that, right? So I think the agriculture sector is an area where the longer it goes on, the worse it gets, but the damage has been done in the areas that they're, you know, whether it's corn, wheat, for example,
for the longer term. Right. So the question is how much of that is already priced in by the markets, yep, right?
That's it. Well, there's risks, like, you know, there's risks to keep an eye on. So, for example, like, you know, Belarus and Russia account for 30% of the world, I think 30% of the world's fertilizer. And then Russia's recently said we're not going to be exporting fertilizer for a few months. So then you got Brazil. Brazil's an agricultural superpower, but Brazil requires, it gets 80% of its fertilizer inputs from abroad. And so planting season begins is also coming up. It comes through four times a year, but they're going to need tremendous amounts of fertilizer for soybeans and things like this. So we'll see whether this is priced in on the markets. Then if you deal with, you know, if there's ever droughts or things like that come out of nowhere. So I would keep an eye on the agricultural sector because of this, right? So these ramifications, right, that we're seeing play out.
Yeah, that would probably put Canada in a pretty good economic spot. I mean, we have potash, we have all sorts of elements that go into the making of fertilizers. So what's your take on that? What's Canada's position
in all? When you look at Canada, right, like, you know, you're right, we have the farmland, we have the water reserves, we have some mineral reserves, you know, and so you have all these areas where we're worried about, you know, in terms of supplies, we tend to have a fair amount of it. So you could say from an economic perspective that, you know, we're in a tough situation in the global economy. We're well positioned, right, if you look at it. And another area I think we're well positioned is when you look at Canada or North America, is when you look at Europe, for example, geographically, they're very unlucky. They're surrounded by by countries in various levels of instability, whether it's North Africa with Libya, you take Turkey, you take Syria, which is not far, then you throw in Belarus and Russia. We're surrounded by two oceans in the United States. So in addition to the reserves we talked about, we're also geographically lucky, right? And so this is an important point. And another point, when you compare us to, you know, North America or Canada to Europe, already also had much higher electricity prices than us, even before the Ukraine situation, you know, broke out. And in a world that's the prices have become higher, in a world that's becoming increasingly automated, I always tell clients that electricity is almost the new labor when you're analyzing the competitiveness of firms and sectors and countries. So that puts them at a big disadvantage. So, you know, Europe's been accused of like closing a lot of its traditional sources of energy before they properly assured that alternative energy was ready to take the lead. And the problem with Europe right now is that even if you decide that, you know, you have to make some corrections, you have to speed up your alternative energy, you got to build more LNG, maybe you got to produce more natural gas in general, that takes years, right? That could take years. It takes 3 years to build up LNG. It could take years to build up more alternative energy. And so they're going to have a challenge because, unlike past crises in the European Union, you can't rely on the central bank and quantitative easing to undo an energy supply bottleneck, right? And this is a challenge for Europe. And that's why, when I think, when you look at Europe from an investment perspective, we should be focusing on those companies that I kind of half jokingly say that are Europe in name only, those that not only export abroad, but have a lot of their production abroad. And so, for example, you know, I'll give one company, BASF, which is a German chemical company, and I'm not recommending it, but it's just an example of a company which is German, but they have a lot of their production in the United States because natural gas, which accounts for 70% of the cost of making chemicals, is much cheaper in the U.S. And so you have a lot of these European companies that have a lot of their production abroad, which means they're partially cushioned against some of these higher prices. And I think that's how I would be looking at Europe, at least part of how I look at Europe, if I was, you know, trying to choose companies for my portfolio, for example.
Yeah. And what about Europe's, you know, will to gain strategic independence from, or decoupling from, the United States to have sort of its own way and representing the West in all of that? Do you see the conflict in Ukraine worsening that of happening anytime soon? I know Europe has always been very weak structurally on an economic standpoint, but it seems that it's getting worse and worse for them. What's your thought on that?
Well, you know what, when it comes to Europe, and I'll explain it, I'll get into that also, is that Europe is at risk of, even when they make the energy transition, they're at risk of becoming, going from being, you know, dependent on oil and gas imports, and in the future, being dependent on the minerals and the refined minerals that are needed to build up the electricity infrastructure in terms of imports. They're going to have to import those as well. And part of the challenge for the West has been for a long time is that we've, you know, large sectors of our population, particularly the younger generation, has kind of equated mining with environmental degradation. And now we're turning around and telling them we need the mines for the green revolution. Now, here in North America, we'll make some progress in building up mining infrastructure. I don't think it'll be sufficient. We'll still not, we don't have enough. But in Europe, it'll be very difficult to do, right? And the environmental movement is much more stronger. And, you know, and I remember, you know, talking to people in Europe and, you know, and then we're discussing where, you know, how Europe banned shale gas production recently. And then there's been efforts in Europe to bring back rare earth mineral production. But rare earth mineral production, I jokingly, you know, it makes natural gas, shale gas production look like a Greenpeace event, right? It's much more intensive, right? I know, for example, when you're mining for gold, it's like the equivalent of pulling a chocolate chip from a cookie. When you're mining for rare earth minerals, it's like the equivalent of pulling a grain of sugar from a cookie. It's much more intensive. And this was a person who's an expert in this from government, Ottawa government, that told me this, right? Explaining the challenges. So Europe is going to be dependent, whether it's on energy imports, but it'll also be heavily dependent on the mine, on the imports of the refined minerals, and you know, needed for the green energy revolution, right? And so Europe, it'll be difficult to find its own voice because of this, right? They'll always be reliant on other parties. Well, we're much more energy independent in North America, and it's much more an advantage, right? Our electricity costs are, you know, when you look at North America, as I mentioned before, we're surrounded by oceans. We have the water reserves. We have the land reserves. We have cheaper electricity. We have more mineral reserves, part of which is necessary for the green transition. We also are a real country, so we can move quicker. Sometimes in Europe, it's like herding cats, right? So there's a lot of disadvantages and challenge that Europe's going to be facing that make choosing companies there, you know, we have to be more careful when you're looking at some of the companies there and taking into account these factors.
Angelo, let's switch gear a little bit and talk about China. In your mind, how much of an input are they in the resolution of this conflict?
Well, you know what, when it comes to China, like this situation, I think for them, and it's mostly like a double-edged sword, right? In the beginning for China, they looked at these tensions just before the conflict as being a net positive, because it basically distracted the West from China, from Taiwan, from the, you know, from alleged business practices of its companies, you know, and so they had less time to focus on Asia. Russia was going more deeply into your zone of influence. You could pick up commodities on a deep discount, right? And so you were gaining, but as the war picked up and some of the commodity prices went up and the oil and gas prices up, and then the worries over global growth, China's starting to say, look, this is really perhaps impacting our economy, right? And there's also at a time when, you know, China's one of the strongest parts of China's growth has been the exports, because China's dealing with a lot of domestic challenges, whether it's COVID or whether it's dealing with the struggling property sector. And the last thing China would need now is to be potentially hit by sanctions from a newly unified West for supposedly, let's say, helping Russia bypass some of the sanctions, right? And this is something that it's ironic that this has really unified the West. As before, when America put sanctions against China, it was really the United States going alone, with Europe kind of sometimes following and sometimes not. And now this is, you know, this crisis has newly unified them. So you would be facing sanctions from your two largest export markets and sources of technology. So that's why I think I'm hopeful. I hope that China begins to look at this and then put pressure maybe on Russia to agree to a deal, because it's perhaps going to start to impact them, right? It's going from before the hostilities grow on, from being a net positive to perhaps being a net negative, right? So that's something that I think we'll see if China does put pressure to end this conflict, right? It's hard to say, because they'll be always behind the scenes and we don't see a lot of public pronouncements coming from their government. But for them, it's a bit of a double-edged sword now, turning into a bit of a net negative, for example.
I understand. I got you. So a few years back, we had the trade war. We had the effects of the pandemics on the supply chains. So do you see the Ukraine war accelerating the formation of this new world order that we're hearing about, economic blocks of some sort?
Well, the problem, you know what? It's you're right. It's a it's an acceleration of what I call the rejigging of supply chain. So you start with China-U.S. tensions, you know, where they said we got to rejig our semiconductor supply chains, for example. We go to COVID. We all woke up and said it's crazy. You know, it doesn't make sense that we rely on imports for our medical supplies and medical equipment. And now we're dealing with this crisis that is leading Europe to say, for example, we got to be less reliant on Russia. But the challenge with Russia is that when it comes to Europe, for example, is that they're heavily reliant on commodity imports from Russia, whether it's nickel, copper, palladium, titanium. And the problem with that is that's not something you can diversify quite easily, right? You got to find new supply. And if you want to build new mines, it can take up to, according to the International Energy Agency, it can sometimes take 16 years from the moment you find the reserves and get the approval to get a mine up and running. So it'll be a challenge to try to find new sources of supply when it comes to some of these areas. Now, I also think what we're seeing in this new landscape is that we're seeing the speeding up of economic blocks, right? You know, one led by United States, perhaps one led by China, with Russia now as a junior member. And this is, for me, even before this crisis, if you looked at United States and China, they already had separate internet systems, they had separate GPS systems, they had separate payment systems, and I think we're moving towards separate financial systems. Like if you're China, you will, you know, seeing how that Russia was able to have its part of its foreign reserves frozen, it really raised alarm bells in China, and they're saying we can't let this happen to our reserves. I think, you know, the estimates are about 50% of China's reserves are U.S. dollars, maybe another 10 or 15 are euros. It's a state secret, so you don't know for sure. But if you're China, you're really going to try to, you know, rush efforts to develop alternative payment systems, maybe a focus on digital currencies, because of with digital currencies, in theory, you can trade directly between the central banks of countries, for example, without going through the U.S. financial system, right? And that's what China's working on. Whether they'll also try to be less reliant on Western currencies, but they'll buy more gold for their reserves, I don't know. But you know that China has really taken notice of how Russia had its parts of its foreign reserves frozen, and they're really, you know, they're going to make efforts to develop what I call a separate financial system. And also in regards to the supply chain, I think we're seeing a greater focus on, you know, on security over efficiency. And that, you know, you could argue that's a good thing because we all want to have access to medicines. But when you, for example, instead of producing, let's say, medicines from two factories in India or China for the world, if every region does it, what you gain in security of supply, you lose in economies of scale. You have regional supply chains, right? And so that adds to costs, right? That's the side effect of this, right? And I think also geopolitics come into when you're analyzing companies, you have to analyze geopolitics. Sometimes the best company won't get the contract for reasons of geopolitics, because the block, for example, an economic bloc might want to develop its own companies in that area, even if they're not as efficient as the services that could be provided from another company based in another zone of influence. So there's a lot of different factors to take into account now, when you're analyzing things from an investment perspective.
Okay, so in your mind, who's the best position to benefit from all of that? You already talked about Canada and its close ties to the United States, but what about China? I mean, China's been hit very hard last week, losing almost 10% to 15% in a matter of just a couple of days. Can they rebound anytime soon in such an environment?
Well, China does control. It dominates the supply chains when it comes to the minerals and the refining of minerals, right? For the alternative energy and electric vehicles, they dominate it. They dominate the batteries. They dominate, you know, the production of rare earth minerals. They dominate the refining, right? Even if they don't produce the lithium, you have to send the lithium back to China to get refined. So they really are ahead of us when it comes to the battle and the control for the resources, right? And I think that's another thing. Like, so they already are ahead of us, right? And if you look at it from the perspective of Europe, you're relying on oil and gas for imports, but one could argue that you're reliant on the supply chains in China for the alternative energy you're building up right now, for solar, for wind. A lot of the components and the minerals and the refined minerals come from that. So I'll take an example for refined rare earths again. Right now, America, you know, they don't produce, you know, China produces the vast majority of rare earth minerals. They refine almost all of them. So America needs to rely on China for the refined rare earth minerals they need for its warships in order to face China, for example, in the Asian seas. It's not a good place to be in. And what this also means is that when you're investing, for example, you have to analyze to yourself not only the profitability of the sector, you have to analyze whether it's geopolitically important. So, for example, in 2011, when prices of rare earth minerals collapsed, we in the West, given that we were like free market, we let all our companies go bankrupt. China subsidized theirs, and then we became dependent on them. So now, if ever prices collapse in key crucial commodities, I feel that, you know, the Western governments, in particular, for example, the Pentagon, they can't let these companies go bankrupt. They're going to have to maintain, you know, sources of supply for reasons of national security. So analyzing which sectors are crucial for national security are important as well, right? But China is, as I get back to the original part of the question, they're very far ahead, right? Either they control the production, but if they don't, you have to send back, you have to send it back there for refining. You got to send back the lithium to be refined, the cobalt to be refined. So they're very far ahead of us when it comes to the supply chains that are needed for electric vehicles or alternative energies for the future.
Well, Angelo, we could talk about this for hours. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us today. Everyone, thank you very much for tuning in. This is that's it for our podcast for today. We will talk very shortly.